Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Take a trip down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear as PSP rides again. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium with your hosts, Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium. This is the February 17th edition, and my name is Michael Norris, and I am joined, as always, with my co-hosts Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons. How are you guys doing this evening?
Great, guys. How are you doing?
Doing wonderful. Doing wonderful. No snow on the ground in Atlanta. I'm happy to report.
Did it snow in Atlanta today?
No, it's actually, it was 70 degrees here today with the sunshine. It's going to be 71 tomorrow and 72 Sunday or Saturday. So,
man,
great weather.
It's been nice here, too. I think I haven't noticed, but I think we're either about to begin the Mardi Gras season or already into it. I'm not sure. I don't venture downtown to Mardi Gras anymore. I kind of outgrew that when I was a senior in high school.
I saw an email to their Facebook page today from Mr. Percy Pringle, and he said the first parade was tomorrow night. So, fixing to get wild and crazy down there.
Yeah, it is. It doesn't take much for that to happen here anyway. Mardi Gras, they just use an excuse to be worse. But Mobile is the originator and the home of Mardi Gras. A lot of people think, associate New Orleans with Mardi Gras because they're so much famous, more famous for it, and they do have bigger wilder parades. Mardi Gras, actually, that tradition actually started here in Mobile, and the gentleman who is credited for starting it is actually buried in the Church Street Cemetery in downtown Mobile, a gentleman by the name of Joe Kane. He is the one who is, most historians give credit to coming up with the idea of Mardi Gras. So, whether you love it or hate it, you can either praise him or blame him for that. So, but, guys don't do anything. Well, does Savannah do anything like that, Jerry?
No, their big thing is St. Patrick's Day.
That's right.
It's gigantic here.
And for some reason, Pensacola is real big for St. Patrick's Day.
Jerry, they still turn the river green down there?
They do every year. Everything turns green.
Jeez.
It's a big deal here. Real big.
Yeah, they do that in Chicago, too. But I can't remember what I was reading, but I was reading something that was talking about Chicago and that the pollution in the river that runs through Chicago, whichever river it is actually so bad, in order to get it to turn green, they have to pour red stuff in it.
Probably green on its own. It's probably
it turns it green.
It glows, doesn't it?
Well, Atlanta used to have a few things like that. Do they still do first night, Bobby?
No, there's not a whole lot goes on here. Freaknik, when they had that a couple of years here, that kind of turned everything else sour here. Freaknik was designed for the black college kids, and they all converged on Atlanta, and it was far greater than anybody here could ever have anticipated, and they basically gridlocked this town for 3 days. I mean, you could not go anywhere. And they were, as college kids, the drunker they got, the more clothes they took off. There was people dancing naked on top of cars, and it was the wildest thing you've ever seen. And
they did that, 2 years in a row?
They did it for 2 years. Then the mayor said, nope, no more. The third year he would not let them inside the city. He made them stay on 285. So they rode around in circles, you know, all weekend, and they figured that wasn't as much fun as they thought they were going to have, so they quit coming.
Actually, I was working downtown at the Macy's store downtown at least the first 2 years of it. And the first year wasn't bad. I mean, there was a lot of people, but, you know, they were on their best behavior, and they were just, you know, just like a bunch of tourists. And Macy's actually made a lot of money, that downtown store did. In fact, we extended our hours, and they made a lot of money those 3 days. And then the second year, you're right, it was, you know, it was everybody standing on cars, whether it was their cars or somebody else.
Oh, yeah, it was crazy.
And taking their clothes off and everything else, and it just absolutely got worse. But the first year, it was a blast. I mean, you know, it reminded me of me growing up down here. It kind of reminded me of Mardi Gras without the floats. It was you know, a lot of fun. But the second year, it killed it quick.
Well, when St. Patrick's Day rolls around, I'll be sure and stay on the internet to see if we see Jerry running naked, painted green down the middle of Savannah.
Idiots. I promise you that, brother. I may be naked. It won't be downtown running around.
I understand. You know, Mike, before we, I know you got a topic for us, but before we go, I just want to kind of just thank everybody that might be listening and helped out with that Ted Allen Memorial Show the other night. I thought it was put together very well, and you know, if my estimator still works, there was probably 300 people there, and a good crowd. And
it said 650.
No, did they say that many?
Yeah.
But there was it was great. I mean, I don't know how many of them got in free, but it was a. It was a heck of a. The guys that participated in the matches worked hard, and it was just it was a good night. Great tribute to Ted's memory, and I'm already seeing things posted that they're going to try to do it again next year and take it to Cartersville, to Ted's hometown. So maybe they'll make it a yearly thing. I hope so.
I think that's what the plan is. They're going to do it annually, and try and relocate it at some point to Cartersville, which would be great.
I don't know if anybody heard this tonight.
There's been a lot of pictures put up and everything, but go ahead, Mike.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't know if you read this or not, but Ted's mom was there, of course, and she never goes to the wrestling matches. And she said when Ted came to her, and well, she told me before we started, we were talking, and she said that her husband, before they married, when they were dating, he took her to a wrestling match. And he said he just got beside himself as a fan at the matches, and said she just never got it. She didn't understand it. And she said when Ted came to her and said, I want to be a wrestler, she said her question to Ted was, why? And she said now that she has been to the matches and she saw this the other night and how everybody actually felt about him and the testimonials of the people he helped and he trained and the things he did, she made this comment when it was over the other night. She said, I now know why Ted had to do what he had to do. He didn't just belong to me. He kind of belonged to everybody. And I think that kind of sums up the way a lot of people felt about Ted. So I thought it was very well put.
Yeah, it was definitely a great night. And I would have to say the testimonial that you and Jenny Powell gave capped the night for me.
Well, I appreciate
you
it.
You probably knew him better and longer than anybody that was there. And I know he was listening, and he was, you know, Ted never got overly excited one way or the other. He was one of the calmest people I've ever seen, one of the most laid-back people I've ever known. But he was grinning, and I really appreciated it when you mentioned Rocket as well, because, you know, those two, and I guess it's because the last time I saw Ted was at Rocket's Memorial at the church, and then their deaths coming so close together, I'll always associate those two. you know, it's always going to be, I think, one I'm going to think of the other. And I certainly am glad that you mentioned Rocket as well. Because
I give you a great Ted Allen line regarding Rocket, and we'll go on. Rocket used to run shows about twice a year in Riverdale, his hometown. And he would always run them for the benefit of the recreation department or some football team or baseball team that his kid was. It was always to raise money for something to do with the kids there in Riverdale. And every time Rocket would book the show, he would always book himself against Ted, because he knew that Ted was going to always, you know, it was a night off. He's going to have a good match, wasn't going to get hurt, and he knew it would be a good match. So he must have wrestled Rocket in Riverdale 7-8 times over the years. One of the last times there, he comes out of the ring. He walks back over where I was and some other people, and he goes, "You know, I've come to a conclusion. I can't beat that man in Riverdale, Georgia." So,
very true.
Gonna miss
very
him.
True. Anyway, what I want to discuss tonight is the guests we've had the last few weeks. We have been all over the place and all over the country and talking about different territories and everything. But I kind of wanted to get back and focus this week on Georgia and basically talk about the three decades that as fans saw in the 60s. You two were involved in the 70s. I got involved in the 80s, and you two were still involved in the 80s. So that was the three decades I wanted to kind of focus on tonight. In the Georgia territory, in the research I did today on it, the 60s, and I don't know if it was something very common to the southern states. I know the Carolinas was very much this way. Tennessee was very much this way. The Gulf Coast certainly was. Seemed to be a tag team territory, that most of the main angles and everything revolved around tag teams. And in here, starting in the, say, 61, 62 time frame, the Assassins dominated this territory. Jody and Tom were always the top heels here, always the top tag team here. And it seemed whenever they would leave, because they did travel to other territories, there would be another mass tag team come in and take their place. The Mysterious Medics were in here, or in Georgia, quite a bit. The Red Raiders, which was Dick Dunn and Billy Garrett. And it just seemed like Georgia was a tag team territory. You two obviously saw more than I did. I didn't really see much except for Fred Ward stuff in the mid-60s. And, again, the main focus there seemed to be on tag teams with the Hines brothers. Mario Galento was involved some, but he was either involved with Billy Hines or sometimes Don Carson. Again, Atlanta, Fred Blassie would come in periodically, and they would have a singles. And they didn't even have a single Georgia tag team or title until the mid 60s, 66, 67, somewhere in there.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, they had a tournament that they had the finals of it at the Atlanta Raceway, at the big raceway down in Hampton on a Sunday afternoon, and Sputnik Monroe beat Dick the Bruiser to become the first Georgia heavyweight champion. Well, I'm really showing my age telling that, aren't I?
I'm telling you.
But you're talking about tag teams, and I was just sitting here running through my head. I started going to matches in 1964. That was the first time I ever went to a wrestling match. Now, the top heel at the time I went the first match, I mean, I can only remember three people on the card. Bill Dromo wrestled that night. I remember him because they referred to him as Big Bill Dromo, and to me he looked like a giant because I was just a kid. And the other two was the main event, Lorenzo Perini and Fritz Von Erich. But the tag teams that you were mentioning, you know, I mean, and Jerry can probably add to this more than I can, but think about this. You had the Assassins. You mentioned the Medics. You mentioned the Red Raiders. J.C. Dykes and the Infernos. The Torres Brothers. The Vachons. Stan, Butcher, and Mad Dog on occasion. the Andersons, Lars and Jean. God, I know there's more, but those just popped into my head right off the top of my head, and those were all in the 60s.
And, of course, Conklin Fuller.
Yeah, they made their appearance in Atlanta. They
didn't they didn't make the loop, I don't think.
Yeah, they were the world champions of Atlanta.
You got that right.
And nobody ever beat them either.
But Bobby was just naming names off, you know, a guy you forget. But, you know, I know every territory had great talent. But I would say Georgia and Florida and probably the Carolinas had more talent at one time that was, like Bobby always says, could have been a main, just about from top to bottom, could have been a main event anywhere else.
Yeah.
The talent was just, I mean, and Florida was the same way now, don't get me wrong. But this territory here, it just oozed with talent. Back in the 60s, I remember, you know, when Blassie was here, I mean, God, like when I was in high school, Blassie would, man, we'd go all flock down there on Wednesday nights to see Blassie. I mean, it was just, and then, you know, of course, the Assassins, and I mean, it was just, you know, the talent was just, of course, you didn't know about talent back then, but I mean, you know, everybody was just capable, just really capable of, when they stepped, you know, in the ring, you know, it was just unbelievable. But I think the
handling. What do you think it was that Georgia had so much? I know later on, when cable television came involved, everybody wanted to have that visibility. But in the 60s, you're right, between Atlanta and the Tampa territory, it seemed like everybody that was on top anywhere eventually worked those places, even if it was just for a couple of weeks. And do you think was the territory just the pay that good, the trips that easy? What do you think it was?
Trips. The trips for one thing.
Yeah, it was. Everything was short. The longest trip was Savannah.
That was the tough one. But if you was in Macon, you know, for like a 6 week run, you know, you had Augusta, Macon, Columbus, you know, I mean, it was just nothing. It was easy territory, and you know, I guess you know, because I wasn't wrestling in the 60s, I don't know what the money was, but I guess it was as good here as it was anywhere else in comparison. But I think that the handling of the talent when Garibaldi was here, I remember as just a kid when I met Leo because of my brother-in-law Steinborn, you know, I was around, but not in the business, of course, but. Later on, you know, I used to talk to Leo, and the whole time Leo was here, he never had a battle royal, no cage matches. Of course, the double ring battle royal wasn't in existence yet. That hit in the 70s. And that was, to me, that was I'd draw your house one time, and I'd have burnt the other ring after I did it once. But, you know, I never saw the hoopla with that. You know, and then in the 80s, it changed again with run-ins. Fans looked toward the dressing room more than they did what was happening in the ring. You know, it was just the handling of the talent. But as far as those three decades, the talent was just, I mean, it was here. It was here. And then you know, when Gunkel was up and running, when the split, they had talent too. I mean, and they were getting talent. They were getting talent.
I think Jerry hit a very valid point there. Guys wanted to go where there was a booker that was established at making money. I mean, nobody wanted to go to Oklahoma and drive 3,000-4,000 miles a week if you wasn't going to make any money. But when Garibaldi was here, I mean, they were drawing good houses. I mean, it was nothing for Atlanta to sell out on a Friday night. And you know,
he had Savannah wide open down here, Bobby.
Oh, yeah.
He had, you know, you know, of course, you know, Columbus and Macon and Albany was handled by the Wards and the Freeds and the Ogles over there. That, you know,
yeah,
they handled, they booked their own towns. But when Leo was here, do you know the story about the taping? When Gunkel approached my father-in-law here in Savannah and Steve Manderson in Augusta?
No.
He told them it'd be, how did that go? They was going to make a tape to send to Augusta and Savannah, right, when Leo was doing the booking.
Right.
He was going to really pop it. So he approached my father-in-law and Manderson and Augusta. He told them that he would charge them $250 a week for 10%. Well, Augusta wasn't doing that hot. So my father-in-law, Aaron Newman, told Gunkel, he says, I'll do the 250. So Manderson said, well, I'm not doing it. He said, I'll do the 10%. Well, after they geared those tapes towards Savannah and Augusta, started shooting those interviews and all, next thing you know, Augusta's selling out.
Mm-hmm.
And Manderson is going berserk. He's paying the 10%.
Oh, geez.
He wanted a meeting with Gunkel and my father-in-law. So they go to Atlanta, and he's raising, saying, Newman's only paying $250, and I'm paying 10%. That's the deal you made. He held him to it.
Wow.
But Leo, I mean, he did. I mean, he just, my gosh. Bobby, this is way before you and I got in the business. He'd go to Waycross and sell that place out.
Yes,
Leo
sir.
Would. I mean, he'd take Dandy Jack down there,
oh,
do stuff with him, and sell the joint out. It was,
I never worked for Leo, but everybody
Bobby talked to
said he was one of the most brilliant minds for the wrestling business of anybody that's ever had a pencil.
Well, Bobby Simmons, I know you. I've known you forever. You would have loved him. He never hollered. He never would holler at you. He would never cuss at anybody. I'm not saying he didn't get mad. I'm not talking about screaming, holler mad. He wouldn't do that. But you would have loved working for him.
Hmm.
Leo had that personality. He was always excited. When you know he would talk to you about a match, he would say, "I can see this," and he'd shake his hands, and he would get you into it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you know, his job on Friday nights in Atlanta, he always refereed the main event.
Yep. Yep.
There he was, the booker. He was in the ring.
Les
Not
Thatcher
wrestling
told
his talent, but, you know, I mean, that was Leo. I mean, you would have loved him.
Les Thatcher told me the story when him and Roger Kirby first came into Atlanta. They had him and Roger booked against Lars and Gene Anderson, and of course they were going to push Gene and Lars, you know, to the top to work with the Torres brothers. And they were in Atlanta, and they're like the third match. The Andersons are fairly new, Roger and Les. It was their first night in the territory, and Leo refereed their match. And he said they were supposed to put Lars and Gene over. And he said about 10 minutes into a 30-minute match, Leo whispered in their ears and said, "No, go through on it." He said he changed it right in the ring. And so when they got back in the dressing room, said, of course, Lars and Gene are kind of looking, you know, what's going on. And he said, "There's money here." He said, "You two guys clicked." He said, "Did you see how the people came up?" He said, "I picked up on it." He said, "We'll do this 2 or 3 weeks." And he said, "Then we'll go on and push you guys to the top." He said, "But why look over something that's going to work?"
That's the he could see it, Bobby. He's the only guy I've ever been around that could. That's why he would be in the ring. He felt it. He had that gift of whatever he had, and I've never been around any other booker that ever had it, ever.
He
was a master.
Just with that testimonial, I think that backs up my point there too. That guys wanted to come to places like that. You know, you knew you were going to be treated fair, and that was the short trips, the knowing you were going to be given a fair shake. I think that had a great deal to do with it. And you know, as hard a taskmaster as I heard Gunkel was, and I was around him a little, I never worked directly for him, but as hard a taskmaster as he was, at least you knew his word was his bond. I never heard anybody say that he out and out lied to me. So.
No, he wouldn't do that now. I wrestled for him, you know, but, you know, when he walked in, it was like, oh, my God. You know, he demanded respect. Let me tell you something. He's a first-class guy. He's a classy guy, very handsome man, a big man, and he demanded respect. And you know, he ran it with an iron fist, I'll say that. And you know, he protected it. He really did. But, you know, getting back to Leo, just like we talked about the story when Gunkel fired Tim Woods, he's booked all the way around with Kaninsky. And he comes out of the meeting with Tim Woods, and Leo says, what's going on? Gunkel said, I fired him. And Leo said, what am I going to do? And Gunkel said, that's your problem. Leo's bells and whistles starts turning. He calls Steinborn in Florida, right? Says, be in Augusta tonight. Take Tim Woods' place. You know, I mean, he didn't get rattled. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He didn't get rattled. He could just come up with whatever. I mean, he just knew the business. And here's a guy, and I never saw him wrestle because he got hurt early on. Him and his dad was a chick. His dad was a chick or Gino.
His dad had an uncle, and there was another one named Ralph. Gino? I don't know if Ralph Garibaldi was actually related to them or not,
no.
But his dad was Gino Garibaldi.
Yeah, Gino. And they were over like fat rats in California out here. I mean, Leo was a good-looking guy, you know, young, good-looking 17, 18-year-old kid. But then he hurt his shoulder real bad. Still wrestled some, but then, you know, he started on the other end of the business, and he just had that gift there. He just, and, you know, wherever he went, you know, he was a wonderful person to be around, and an exciting guy to be around too. He was always glad to see everybody, you know, and just it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. It wasn't a strain for him to do it, and he made Ray Gunkel a lot of money. Believe me.
It's always nice when you got somebody like that around that you don't. You look forward to going to work.
There you go, Bobby.
You know,
if you'd have been working in the Georgia office when that man was there, you might have got you a cotton stayed up there. That's the kind of man. That's the kind of pleasure he was to be around.
Hmm.
And I'm sorry, because I'm glad you're not older, but I'm sorry you missed that.
I met him. I got a chance to meet him later on, but I never had the pleasure of working for him.
Right, that's what I mean. You would know what me and everybody else at Russell Point felt.
Yeah.
You know?
Let me throw something else out here, Mike, while we're talking about the 60s and see if Jerry agrees with this. I was thinking about this today when I got your email about what you wanted to talk about. I sometimes think we in the business were our own worst enemies because I was given a piece of advice by Dick Steinborn when I first started. And he told me, and I've tried to not only live by this in the wrestling business, but in everything I do. He told me, he said, Bobby, he said, always work a shoot. He said, if you can't believe it yourself, then how do you expect somebody else to believe it? In the 60s, I can remember going to matches, and I don't know why this particular, I mean, I can even remember it. I can see it in my mind now. I saw Stan Stasiak and Ray Gunkel in Atlanta work a 2-out-of-3-fall match, and I saw Stasiak lose 2 falls, and he gave up both falls in a hammerlock.
See there?
A hammerlock. You know, and you know, we became our own worst enemy. We kept trying to go higher and higher and do more and be, you know. I think, you know, and I mean, where we're at now as far as our business is concerned, but, you know, if you don't believe a hammerlock will make you give up, let a policeman throw a hammerlock on you.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, it's no matter how you sell it.
Leo, for a second, and still talking about what you're talking about. I know Dickie come up one time from Florida. He asked Leo, he said, how do you draw all these houses? I mean, he said, how do you do it? You know what his answer was? What his answer was? I have great talent. That was his answer. But Leo wasn't putting himself over, right? He said, I have great talent. But
yeah.
Leo knew what to do with the talent, guys.
Right.
He knew what to do with the talent. And it's just like when I was running there a few years ago there in Columbus. Man, I'd harp to those guys. I know I sounded like a redundant idiot. Stay in the ring. Don't do this. Don't do that. Because they didn't know. All these guys I was using were outlaw workers, per se, you know.
Yeah.
Some of them were good talent. David Young was a good talent. You know, I used Elix Skipper, and I mean, had some good talent. But they didn't. They never worked for a territory. They never worked for great bookers. I mean, I'm not saying I was, but I was trying to relay what I was taught. And
yeah.
it could still be done today.
Yes, it could.
But they don't, you know, they won't, you know, it's, anyhow. Terry Funk told me when him and Dory went to New York, right? You know Dory style.
Yeah.
Dory style is Dory style. That's it. And they said, Terry told me that, you know how you used to go, boring, you know, they
yeah.
started that crap. He said Junior would get slower until he got them. You know, they wasn't going to tell him how to work.
Yeah.
And guys, today, let that crowd, you know, to me, if you put on a pair of trunks and a pair of boots and you go out there and you can't make the people stand up or sit down or holler or boo or what, then you need to go park the cars when they come into the building.
I had a young promoter.
Go ahead,
I had a young promoter walk up to me. I was at his show. And he walked up and he sat down next to me, and I was sitting in the bleachers watching. And he asked me, he said, what do you think about the show? And I said, well, I said, number one, I think you got too many matches.
I said,
I think you're going too late. I said, you got people here that got to get up and go to work tomorrow. And I said, why are you doing certain things? And he said, because the crowd is into it. Look how they're buying it. Look how they're into it. I said, you're telling me you're letting the crowd dictate what you do? I said, you should be dictating to the crowd what they do.
I tried to tell them. They wouldn't listen. They thought I was from Mars or something.
Yeah.
I'd wrestle for some groups around like that. You'd get there. So how many matches y'all got? 10? 10? I said, there's nobody can hold people for 10 matches.
After the first three, what's the fourth
Columbus.
One going to do that the first three hadn't done? You know.
Thank you. When I was running there in Columbus, I had 5 matches. Would always have a tag team match, you know.
Yeah.
Normally I would. But 5 matches, we're out of there. 2 matches, intermission, 2 more matches, intermission, main event, we to the house. Never kept them over 2 hours. Never. If we kept them, usually it was 1:45 to 1:50. That was it, tops.
Yeah.
You can hold them. You can't hold people 4 hours, unless you hold them hostage.
Well, when you know, Renesto always had the philosophy that, you know, you get them out by a certain time. But every once in a while, you throw something at them where you keep them longer. He said, keep them guessing.
Don't let them
sit there watch by what you're doing. He said, but, you know. He said, that was his philosophy. He said, you get your point across. I mean, I think the thing that people are missing today, and I know with this young promoter, he had no clue what he was going to do the next show. You know, in the days that we're talking about with Garibaldi had figured out, Bob Kelly was another booker that I've heard talk about this. He knew what he was going to do 6 weeks ahead. And
they were some good bookers did.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and, you know,
anywhere.
you're building,
you know,
toward that 6 week, you know, climax out there. It's, and today, you know, they're worried about what they're going to do in the next 15 minutes, not what they're going to do in 6 weeks. So
it's just like if you let's say you run a spot show and you go run it every so, you know, not a regular basis, but just say you go. Let's just say you go run a town every 2 weeks, every week, little spot show.
Right.
You go there and it sells out. Oh my gosh, you've got them there now. Renesto's thing was, we've already got them. Now we got to get them back.
Got to keep them.
Uh-huh. There you go.
Exactly.
Guys, they don't understand. And, you know, like you said, Garibaldi and all these great bookers booked, you know, like 4 to 6 weeks in advance. But that didn't mean it was in stone. Because, you know, things would change. Maybe the guy get hurt, or maybe get mad and quit, or maybe they have to fire a guy, you know. But they had it, you know, you have to have some direction you're going in. It was just, I don't know if you was ever around Louis Tellez as a booker. Were either one of you guys?
A little bit,
no,
yeah.
No.
Yeah.
He was booking some here for Fuller, but I never worked for him.
He was booking Florida when I started. He did a good job down there. He really did. I don't know how he did anywhere else.
He came in as an assistant here in Atlanta. He came in as an assistant booker with Ole for a few months. And I got to work around him some. There again, another brilliant mind for the business. I mean,
I thought he did.
He knew what he wanted. I mean, he had great ideas, and he had here again, he was looking ahead. I mean, I think all great bookers, no matter who they are, they had the foresight to know where they want to go. I mean, their job depends on making money for the promoter, and you know, they had to have some direction, and I think that's missing today. I mean, you know, the product that we have now that we call, or they call, sports entertainment, they're not geared for the next house show. They're geared for the next pay-per-view. So everything they do is on TV. Well, we used our TV as a promotional tool to get them to the house show. And all they're doing now is trying to get you to buy the pay-per-view where you can sit at home and watch it.
Do you think, I'm going to ask both of you guys this question. May have asked you in the past or not before, but do you think, honestly, that I always say New York, WWE, whatever, I just call them New York. Do you think they could run a territory on a weekly basis now?
No.
I don't either. That's not old school, me being from the 70s up to 2010 or whenever I quit. I just believe that they don't have the mind for that to do week after week after week. They could not do it. Couldn't do it. And I don't think they're doing
something. What it goes back to is what Bobby was saying, is that everything that they do on their weekly television program is, you know, what are they running? Pay-per-view every month now?
Every 6 weeks.
So that's as long as their angles run. They build up towards that, and then it's, you know, and then it's dropped.
Well, you know, that would be the easiest thing in the world to do. That would be easier than running a town every week.
Exactly, and that's what I'm saying. That's where they're geared at. They're not thinking of, okay, I've got to have, you know, I've got, say, five different towns. I've got to have five different sets of angles, five different main events, or unless you want to do it the lazy way, like, you know, in my opinion, the way Fuller did it, and run the same show, same finishes in all five towns. You know, which, to me, you know, that was risky. The only town that he didn't run different was Pensacola, because it was close enough to Mobile that people could run, you know, could drive over and see the same. But he thought nothing of doing the same finish in Mobile, Birmingham, Montgomery, you know, and Dothan, and only having Pensacola there. And, you know, that was always strange to me, because having grown up watching, you know, the Lee Fields promotion, think about that promotion. That promotion had three different, basically it was divided into three different sections. You had Mobile and Pensacola that had their own TV. You had Mississippi that had their own TV. You had Dothan, Panama City, Ozark, that end, that had its own TV. Every one of those were run like three different territories. They had three different sets of titles. They had three different, you know, sets of angles and everything else. They would,
but how many
would cross
they
the talent.
How many bookers
do they booked have? Mississippi, Mobile, and Pensacola, and Rocky McGuire booked
the Dothan end.
The Dothan, Panama, yeah. He usually had somebody help, and somebody like Rip Tyler or Billy Hines of Panama City. But it was totally different. And they would use, you know, they would use each other's talent, because Kelly ran five cities over in Mississippi. on top of Mobile and Pensacola. So he had seven cities, and Rocky had three or four. So, you know, there was always going to be the need for those guys to be in equaled up enough to where you've got good talent in all the cities. But even before they reopened Mississippi in 1968, when they were running Louisiana, well, they had six or seven towns down there. And see, that Billy Golden booked that until I think about midway of 67. Then Kelly booked from there till they closed out in early 68, Louisiana. But that's again, to me, a sign of a good booker, that you've got all this stuff going on in all these different cities, and they're all different. I mean, there were times here you'd have Rocket and Flash Monroe heels in Mobile, or heels in Mississippi and babyfaces in Mobile.
Isn't that something?
Even though, they didn't team with somebody they were, in Mobile with somebody that they were feuding with. So it made sense. You know what I mean? If you know what I'm talking about. And it seemed more like a competitive sport by doing it that way to me. But to answer your question, no, I don't think they can, because I don't think they could balance it enough. I don't think if you had guys that worked, eventually they'd get better. It'd be better for the guys. But I don't think that they could remember everything to go by the script on that many different towns in a territory.
Bobby. I was just thinking. In reference here. When we were in the business in the 60s and 70s, we were always, some guy would come in and he would always talk about, well, I've been in New York and we sold the Garden out, 19,000 people. Ole put it in perspective one time. He said, okay, so they drew 19,000 people at the Garden. He said, what is the population of New York City? He said, drew less than 1% of the population of that city into a building. He said, now, If you look at it that way, what'd you draw? He said, you run the Garden once a month, once every 6 weeks.
Exactly.
He said, people say we didn't do any good in Georgia. We were a little territory. People didn't, people would come here and they would leave and say, oh, I can't make any money there. We ran Augusta every Monday night. We ran Macon every Tuesday night. We ran Columbus every Wednesday night. We ran Athens and whatever else we ran, Rome or whatever was at the time on Thursday night. We ran Atlanta on Friday night. And at one time they were running Atlanta and Statesboro. They ran both towns on Friday night, and they finally quit that. And then on Saturday, of course, you had Griffin and Carrollton. And we didn't work Sundays back in the early 70s. But the thing is, we didn't draw any money. Atlanta only, on a sellout, when I was with Barnett, a sellout in Atlanta was like $24,000 if it sold out. But you take that $24,000 and multiply that by 52, how much money did you make? Because we used to sell it out every week.
Well, there you go, see?
Every week.
So they talking about selling Madison Square Garden out. I mean, that's no great feat.
No. I mean,
I see that they not going to run in a Georgia Dome there. Now they going to Phillips Arena.
Well, they're going to do WrestleMania. They're going to do WrestleMania in the Dome.
Huh?
Yeah, they're going to do WrestleMania in the Dome.
I thought Greg told me they were going to go to Phillips Arena with it.
I don't think so. No, they've sold enough tickets. They got to do that one in the Dome. But I think they're going to Phillips. Aren't they going to Phillips the next night for whatever their money? Is it Raw or?
I don't know. You mean to tell me that they're going to do half the Dome or the whole Dome?
No, they're going to do the whole Dome. They generally... For WrestleMania, they generally draw 60,000-70,000 people for that.
Well, I guarantee you, if they get that
in the Hall of Fame that weekend too, so
they
yeah,
give
the Hall of Fame thing is that that's at Phillips, isn't it? Or
I'm
is
not
it
sure.
Fox? They're doing a Hall of Fame thing the night before, but
there's somebody else doing that, isn't it?
No, the Hall of Fame thing is the WWE Hall of Fame.
So what's the thing with Bruno?
That's some kind of wrestle reunion, something or another.
Yeah, that's the thing in August.
Oh, okay. That's how much I know about it. But that, anyhow, I think the great minds of doing what we did are no longer in existence, and it's a different animal now. And I still say, if he was to run, you know, just gear every 6 weeks for a big show, that wouldn't be nothing to do. That would be the easiest thing to do. But you got to draw money in each town, like Bobby just named, like here in Georgia, every week. Come on, man. That's
something else too. And in the 70s, think about when I was telling Jerry Bobby before we went on the air, somebody had sent me a bunch of clippings from Georgia from 73 and 74 when both promotions were running wide open. And to see, you know, you guys were doing business in the same city, sometimes one night after the next, and still drawing. And because the caliber of talent was there and everything. And while we're on that, so I wrote some names down. I'm hoping you can kind of give me a little info. Tracy Rivers. Now, he was what, a coach from Warner Robins or something, a college baseball coach or something that
Tracy Rivers, he played in the Philadelphia Phillies minor league system, and he was some kind of coach or something there, and he went to work for Gunkel, and great athlete, but he was one of those guys that just never clicked in the wrestling business. He knew it. I mean, he was trained well. But he just never, you know, some guys it just never clicks. If you remember the story I told about they were going to make him a referee about the where they had the judges in Columbus, and he threw both discs down. That was Tracy, and that sort of ended his refereeing career the first night. But Tracy was a guy from Warner Robins, and he just. As far as I know, he worked for Gunkel just a few weeks, maybe a few months, and that was all he ever did in the wrestling business.
Okay. How about Bob Hall?
Bob Hall started at the same time that Tracy did. They were trained together, if I remember correctly. And Bob Hall was a former prison guard at Reidsville, which was the maximum security prison in the state of Georgia. And Bob Hall was tall, but he had a little bit of a mean streak. And I know that he worked here, and he also worked up in there was somebody running the West Virginia territory back in those days, and he went up there and worked up there some too. But that's all I ever heard from Bob Hall was here and there.
You know that name? I don't even remember.
Jack Andreas ran that territory up there.
That's who he worked for. Bill McMahon went up there, and. Bill said that Bob Hall got in the ring one night, and he said that they were in some little town. He said he said you couldn't hardly see the people for the coal dust all over them. And one of the dreaded diseases of working in a coal mine is called black lung disease. And he said Bob Hall got in the ring, and he had a nip or two. And McMahon said he was his tag team partner, and he said Bob Hall looked out at the crowd and said, "You black lungers, which one of y'all want to come up here and try me?" And he said it took the state patrol to get him out of the town. So he was he had a little bit of a crazy streak, but
I don't remember him at all, Bobby.
That's he was here for tall guy, dark mustache. He was here for Gunkel, and like he went up to West Virginia, and that was it. That's all I ever heard from him.
Now both of you may know this next one because he was in all the clippings I saw. He was. Described as a local Columbus man, Ken Hoglan.
That's another story. I don't know if Bobby knows the story on him or not.
He was some kind of judo expert or something, wasn't he?
Yeah, and he always come to the matches, and he bugged them in Columbus to let him wrestle, and they tried it, and he got in the ring. It was Leon and him against Rocket and somebody, and of course Rocket worked him over, and that was kind of in his career.
Rocket told me he opened him up from ear to ear is what he told me.
He did.
And then he came over and worked for Gunkel a couple of times. He's the guy that was in Columbus that that we were working, Dickie was promoting, we were working the National Guard Army. This was before we got the deal to go into the auditorium on Monday nights. And he worked with Bill Bowman on a Monday night. And I remember I just started refereeing, and I'm standing in the dressing room, and Dickie came in, and he asked Bill if Bill wouldn't mind putting him over since he was a local guy. And Bill said, yeah. And he said, Dickie asked him, he said, what I'd like for you to do is kind of just throw a karate kick and, you know. And I remember the guy looked at Bill, and he was very serious. He says, I'm not sure I can work that kick. And I remember Bill looking back at him and going, if you don't work it, I have a pistol in my bag over there. I will come back in the dressing room, and I will shoot you.
This guy was a teacher.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
He taught at Phillips College, but he wasn't all there, man.
Yeah, he wasn't around much.
I came across a bunch of clips, and I'll have to ask, I know Bill's listening to us, and I'll have to ask him about it this weekend when I see him. He and Bill worked a series of judo jacket matches.
Oh, jeez.
Bram.
I never had the privilege of being in any of those.
For Gunkle?
Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
You know, I never knew he worked for Gunkle, Bobby.
He was there just very briefly.
I did not know that. You know where he lived?
I knew
he lived at the YMCA in Columbus, Georgia.
Oh, geez.
I told y'all he was different. Y'all didn't want to believe me. Nothing wrong with that, but I mean, he was just—I mean, he was out there, man. He was just different. That's all I can tell you.
Jerry, you disappeared around end of the summer '73 and was gone until April of '74. Where did you go?
Wait a minute. In '73, in the beginning of '73, I was in Dallas.
Okay.
And Leo brought me out there. That was an experience. Dealing with Fritz von Erich, but that's another story, another show. But I'm telling you, for real now, but anyhow. Then I come back here, 73. I stayed here for a while, I think, because my mother-in-law was sick. And Bobby, was that when Watts was in here booking?
It could have been right in the middle of the war.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Because Watts come in, and I had been here a while. I wasn't gone long, and I was here a while when Bill got here. And I tell you what he did for me. He said, you know, it's about time for you to go. I said, yeah, I understand. But he said, I understand your mother-in-law is sick. And he says, you stay as long as you want. He did do that for me. Yeah, I can honestly say he did that. And then I hung around, and then I took off and went to Kansas City.
He punished you another way, though. He made you team a lot with Jim Wilson and Leon Ogle. Well, Leon was Fritz. You did a lot of matches with Jim Wilson as your partner.
That was another one.
Oh, jeez.
He just keeps pulling them out of the hat, doesn't he?
Oh.
Well, you missed it. Go ahead.
You know, I couldn't believe it when I saw Wilson had passed away. I was in shock.
Yeah.
What happened to him, Bobby?
Heart attack, as far as I know.
Yeah, I think
what was he doing in Atlanta?
Well, nothing I know of. I mean, he was always looking to sue somebody.
Yeah.
And he wrote that book that he wanted everybody to believe, and it was 99% lie, and the other 1% was, you know, questionable. And it was just he was a piece of work. You talking about piece of work?
Oh, I used to ride with him sometimes. He always had a Cadillac convertible.
Oh.
And I'd ride to towns with him. I finally stopped that. That man scared me to death, man. Wilson was something else, I'm telling you.
He came to work for Ann, and when we were right in the middle of the feud there, Dickie ran a show at Golden Park, the baseball park there in Columbus. and he was in a six-man tag, and the baseball team was in town. It was just an off night when we ran there, and they wouldn't let us use the locker room. So Dickie rented a room, two rooms over at the Heart of Columbus Motel where the guys could go over and change. Well, Wilson shows up at the ballpark. He don't know he can't get dressed there, so they send him over to the hotel. And I don't know what he was on, but he was kind of on his own little planet that night. And when he went over there, he forgot what he went over there for. And almost time for the matches, he ain't showed back up. They sent somebody over, and they found him over there sitting in the room with the TV on, and he's reading the paper.
I believe it.
I mean, he was a piece of work. And, you know, somebody told him he was a great wrestler one time, and he believed it, but I never saw him. I mean, he was horrible.
But, you know, he wrestled in off seasons from football, you know.
Yeah.
I know the first time I saw him was in Florida.
You know, for every one guy that came out of football that thought he could wrestle that was halfway, was pretty good or halfway decent, there was 50 of those guys that was horrible.
Yeah. Well, I guess Wahoo and Ernie were the best.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. Without a doubt. Ron Pritchard was good. But
I was never around him much.
I had the privilege of working with Otis Sistrunk. Another fine Columbus
native. Wait a minute. You say that lightly now, because Ole had me to try to train him.
Oh, God.
My gym in Columbus. You know, I train guys down there.
Yeah.
Nobody told me, I want you to train Sistrunk. I said, you got to be kidding me, man. I couldn't do much with him, you see.
Mike Sharp, nice guy, you know, but everybody always kidded about how dumb Mike Sharp was. One night I went to a town that Leon was running for Fred, under a mask, team with Mike Sharp against George Wells and Otis Sistrunk. And I'm going to tell y'all something. Mike Sharp's not as dumb as everybody said he was, because I realized every time Otis was in the ring, Bobby was in the ring.
Bobby was the nut, right?
Oh, jeez.
That's a big man, wasn't he?
Oh, he was a big old fella, buddy, but he didn't have a clue.
Mike Sharp. Yeah.
Oh.
If he was on second, time the main event got out, he was still in the shower.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you remember that?
Oh, yeah. And David went in three times his age.
Probably a shower that day.
Oh.
But, you know, I never saw Mike Sharp, but he wasn't dressed in an expensive suit, pressed shirt, tie, everything. You know, guys would be showing up in flip-flops and
oh, yeah.
All that stuff, and he'd come in with that suit on and never said a word, but he would have been straight to the shower.
Where'd he wind up, Mike?
I don't know. He worked up there for years in New York. It basically, you know, he just put people over. And
one
I would imagine he ended up back in Hamilton, which is where he was from.
One other name before we get gone that you mentioned earlier, or I did, or somebody, was Louis Tillet. Where's Louis?
Louis lives in Highlands, North Carolina.
In where?
That's right. He is in
Highlands, North Carolina. The Highlands. It's a gated community up there. And Louis, they're telling me he's kind of got a little bit of Alzheimer's now.
Does he really?
Yeah. I know we're fixing to go, but you said something there, Mike, and I just want to throw this out. You're talking about the 60s and the 70s, 80s, and Jerry can confirm this. If we had showed up at the matches in flip-flops and shorts, we'd have got fired.
Right now.
Yeah.
In a heartbeat.
But, you know, in Florida, that's the way the boys dress, which that was a different scene.
That's a different part of the world. Yeah.
That was their scene down there.
I don't even ever remember going to the matches in a sweatsuit.
I don't either. Let me tell you something. I mentioned Louis Tillet. That was a piece of talent, too, in the ring.
Yes, sir.
Don't think he wasn't. He wasn't the biggest man, but I'm telling you, he's very, very talented. I enjoy being
around. Well, we are out of time, guys, and I certainly appreciate it, as always. We didn't quite get into everything I wanted to, but that's all right. We never do.
We never do.
Better for it.
let me lay out a format for
but
you.
Let me tell you, the stuff we do talk about is interesting.
But you don't throw out. you ought to just throw out questions and see if we can answer them. And then you lay it out like that, and it still won't work, but you can try it.
Yeah.
We'll play Wrestling Jeopardy. How about that?
Yeah, if we don't know, we'll make something up.
Not that we ever have. But,
Well, guys, we will do this again next week, and I appreciate it as always.
I enjoyed it, fellas.
Looking forward to it, guys.
See you guys later.
Good night.
Good night.
Welcome to Ringside Wrap, a production. We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.